Hello to everyone in the US, Israel, Palestine, and other places in the world. Welcome to this latest installment of Conversations with Israel and Palestine, hosted by Partners for Progressive Israel. Conversations with Israel and Palestine is a series of informational webinars that brings voices from Israel and Palestine to an American audience, providing an important link between progressives in the US and in the Middle East. My name is Gilad Halpern. I'm an Israeli journalist, broadcaster, and media historian. Some of you may know me as the co-host of the Tel Aviv Review podcast, which is a platform for in-depth discussions of books and ideas, as well as the co-editor of the recently launched Tel Aviv Review of Books magazine. Over the next 60 minutes, I'll be serving as the moderator of this discussion. But before we get started, I'd just like to say that Partners for Progressive Israel is an American not-for-profit organization dedicated to the achievement of a durable and just peace between Israel and its neighbors, and believes in the need to ensure civil rights, equality, and social justice for all of Israel's inhabitants. Partners seeks to deepen Americans, and especially American Jews, understanding of Israel's complexities in order to enhance their ability to advocate for a progressive Israeli future. Let me now introduce our two panelists. One is Rabbi Shaul David Yudelman. He's the co-director of Roots, a local Israeli-Palestinian initiative active within the communities at the front line of the conflict between Hebron and Jerusalem. The other is Dr. Dalia Shendlin, a political consultant and an expert on Israeli-Palestinian conflict and peacemaking issues. Let me just add that the discussion will go on for about 40 minutes, after which we'll be answering questions from the video audience. I encourage you to type in your questions at any time, starting now. All you need to do is look at the bottom of your monitor for the icon that reads Q&A. You may need to touch your screen or run your mouse over it. Then click on the icon and type your question in the small box that appears. The webinar won't disappear or be disrupted. Please note that viewers' microphones are turned off and questions can only be asked when typed in this way. And I, as the moderator, will read them out. And one last thing before we get started, I've been asked to share a note from Partners for Progressive Israel. Partners for Progressive Israel is aware of and sensitive to the need to include Palestinian voices on panels that deal with issues that have a bearing on Palestinians. Partners also believes that the conflict and the peace process involve both intra-Jewish conversations as well as Israeli-Palestinian ones, since it's Israeli Jews who have the greater power in the Israel-Palestine conflict. The key challenge in this process is scaling down distrust and persuading those who have the greater power to share it. So Partners feels it's legitimate, even essential, that intra-Jewish conversations also take place. That being said, Partners plans to arrange a future program on this theme, which would include a Palestinian participant or participants, and is striving towards more inclusion of Palestinian panelists generally. So for now, the topic of our discussion will be, can settlers and leftists work together for peace? And please, let's get started. Shaul, I'd like to start with you. Can you tell us and the audience what Roots is and the work that it does? It is not quite what we are used to hearing when it comes to settlers in the West Bank.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think every single person involved in Roots on the Israeli and Palestinian side is very much their own path of how they got there. It's for some people, it's about hope. Some people, a lot of people, it's about pain, about frustration, a lot of it about stuck, about questioning, where is it going? And all those things, I think for both sides, demanded a lot of challenging our ideologies, our perspectives, where we came from. And so for me, a lot of it sits on the late Rabbi, Rabbi Menachem Fuhrman. Was a teacher, was a member of the settlement movement who believed deeply in the Jewish connection to the land of Israel. But I, you know, there's that famous, very outdated statement that a land without a people, for a people without a land. You know, the blindness that it took to see that, to say that, blindness of ideology, blindness of reality. Rabbi Fuhrman was a person who deeply challenged that blindness, that blind faith. And he stood within the settlement movement, challenging from the inside, saying, "We need, if we want to talk about a future here, we need to talk about changing the way we're seeing things." And he believed deeply in a partnership with Palestinian society. You know, he became a confidant of Yasser Arafat. You know, I think when Hamas started sending suicide bombs, Reb Fruman didn't adopt the Israeli government's policy of "we don't negotiate with terrorists." He said, "If Hamas is a voice in reality, then you have to relate to that voice." So for me, part of it is the ability to let down those walls, either the physical walls or the ideological walls we live in, and look at reality. And I see where I live in Tekoa, the Bethlehem region here. Palestinian life's around me. And how much does the settler movement, the Jews who live here, allow themselves to see that? I think it's really ebbed and flowed over the years. I didn't grow up here, but I have a good friend, Elias, who grew up in Elkanah, moved out to the settlements in the early 80s. And that first wave of coming back to the land, he said we learned Arabic in our class. There was no gate around the fence. We walked around and hung out with met Palestinians, Arabs in the local area. And there's a generation here on both Israeli and Palestinian side that remembers that. Not saying it was perfect. Of course, you couldn't raise a Palestinian flag. You'd be arrested by the IDF for that. But at the same time, there's that level of connection, the level of seeing each other, to which today's political reality, we have now a generation on both sides that lived under the separation paradigms of both Oslo and what happened because of Oslo. That can't imagine that. So for some of it's a little bit about drawing on that. If we want to love this land, that includes the people of this land, that includes the challenge that the land gives us. If Roots for me says that the land devours its inhabitants, like it says in the Bible about this holy land, it devours its inhabitants. That means the ideologies or visions we come here with, if we want to be open with this land, they have to be something open to something bigger than just what we got here with. At the end of the day, it's a very local initiative. It's people in this region, south between Jerusalem and Hebron, who, you know, like I said, each person in their own way started questioning where this is going, what's our responsibility. And the word settler includes quite a wide swath of people. Most settlers probably don't know are anti-Zionists, right? Are ultra-religious Jews living in Modin Elit or in Beitar are not Zionists. They're ultra-religious, they're settlers. You have people in Gush Etzion who are two-staters. They believe in the two-state solution. It's not happening right now, but they felt Gush Etzion was in the consensus of that, they'll stay there. You have people who believe vastly different things, who people of exclusive claim, not willing to give up. But to step in, meaning as when I ended up moving out here about 20 years ago, there's all kinds of different voices out here. And so Ruth started challenging that, I think standing up and kind of, for me personally, it was about when there's an increase in Jewish violence, in Jewish extremist violence, and who was willing to take a stand against that? Who was going to stand and say, this is a crime? And that meant going to a mosque after a price tag attack and with Rabbi Fruman and condemning the attack, and talking to the rabbi in my town, finding out about things going on and who's going to start seeking those voices. And that kind of a collective of people came up around that. Like I said, there's also the latent connections between Jews and Palestinians in this area that remember each other. And there's a general consensus that Oslo hasn't worked out. Is there really going to be a separation? Is it really right to deny either side's their heritage? And at Roots, we kind of end up with this conversation, bringing in religious Jewish settlers, for people who believe in the Jewish connections of this whole land, and Palestinians, and I'll say many of them from a refugee background. And I think I understand 65% of Palestinian society are refugees from 1948. And that challenge to me, in my classic, you know, hopes of peace, is we're going to split the land and both sides have to take their stock. But being exposed to that, for me, also deeply challenged what I thought was possible in peace and shattered some of the conceptions that had been peace. And I just came across the old piece that Rabbi Fruman wrote in 1996, after the right, after Bibi comes to power, after the assassination of Rabin, and the right comes to power. And Rabbi Fruman says, I'm challenging our new leaders to say, if it's not Oslo, then what? What's another option for peace? Because to say no to Oslo is different to say no to peace. And to be stuck in the two-state paradigm is one example of peacemaking, but perhaps there's other horizons. And I find a lot of people on both sides of the map here are seeking that. It demands getting over some of our old ideologies, it demands opening up to some visions and cosmologies or perspectives on life that maybe aren't ours. Religious people, secular people, traditional people. But I find that bringing this oftentimes religious or traditional, but deeply nationalistic on both sides, bringing them face to face to acknowledge the legitimacy of the other side, is something that opens up a conversation that really, really hasn't been going on. And
what are really the themes of that conversation? I mean, I'm sure that the Palestinians that you speak to are even more skeptical of the fact that you are settlers than Israeli leftists are.
It's interesting about that because reality is very powerful. Ideology is also powerful. Ideologically, the settlements are illegal and da 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 da. And the Oslo process was supposed to remove them. 30 years later, nobody's gone anywhere. There's more settlements. Life is incredibly interwoven. And I can make a distinction between people in Palestinian villages in Area C versus people in the cities. Difference between the political lines and where society is at. And I don't like talking about the connections between Jews and Palestinians as if there's no political problems here. But there is a world of life and an employment, things that do go on here, and those relations exist. But the challenge is obviously to step up. It's not about speaking legitimacy is one side, but actually standing up and getting roots. There's a world of people-to-people things. There's a world of activism. There's a world of getting involved in land access and house demolitions and water issues and responding to violence. And on both sides, the question I think both sides need to see, there's importance in the legitimacy conversation and the recognition, but both people have a deep sense there's no partner. There's no partner on this side. Who's condemning the attack? Who's standing up for our rights? So bringing the people to see people from the other side standing up for those rights is a very powerful part of transformation. And Dalia, that's why...
Dalia, I want to ask you about, in relation to what Joel just said, with the decline of the two-state paradigm and the popularity thereof, both in Israel and among the Palestinians, do you see Shaul's ideas gaining more traction? I'm asking you as a pollster and political consultant, someone who knows what public opinion is.
Yeah, well, you're right, first of all, to point to the decline on both sides. What we've seen over the last decade in public opinion surveys is a slow and incremental but very consistent decline in support on both sides, to the point where both among Israeli Jews and among Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, support is below half and opposition is over half. Not far below half, it's still, the two-state solution is still the solution that people support more than other solutions. But the only population between the river and the sea that supports it with a strong majority are Palestinian citizens of Israel, Arab Israelis. And what I usually get asked at this point is, what do they support instead? There is no instead. Every other solution, when we talk about solutions, is supported less. So if Israeli Jews and Palestinians supported a two-state solution at over 40%, maybe 43%, 45%, depending on the survey, a single one state, you know, a democratic equal one state or a binational state is supported by about half that among Jews and among Palestinians, maybe just around a third or a little bit more. So I think what we're seeing is a real despair over the idea of solutions. The idea of a solution, if you mention it among many circles, even among much of the left in Israel, it's almost like embarrassing because nobody really believes there is a solution that will solve the problems. In some ways, I think that's realistic. I think that for too long, at least from the Israeli left-wing perspective, trying to convince the Israeli public, there's been this sense that we have to prove that we have all the answers, that we can solve everything, that we can stop every stone from being thrown by every 15-year-old. And that's always been unrealistic as an expectation and as a promise. And so in some ways, there's something rather realistic about the sense that, guess what? We all admit now that there is no perfect solution. I think that's a good thing because it allows us to open up the reality of what paradigms weren't working before. In the meantime, though, there's a void. There's no political prescription on either side right now. The Palestinian leadership still talks about a two-state solution, but it looks very much like a fiction. The Israeli side speaks actively against it. And so when you ask if these ideas that Shaul was talking about are gaining traction, I wouldn't say there's a mass movement, but I do think that in among people who think that there is a problem that needs to be either solved or at least, like I say, we can do better, that they're searching for different ways of doing better. And some of us are looking at, you know, alternate frameworks, constitutional frameworks for resolving the conflict. Again, resolving in a qualified way. And others may come to the conclusion that there will not be any movement towards a political resolution right now from the leadership. And so it's up to people to take matters into their own hands at a grassroots level of dialogue. You know, my general approach as a person is let 1,000 flowers bloom. They all have a role. I don't think there are huge numbers, the kinds that would show up in a quantitative survey, who have the opportunity that Shaul is talking about, right? You know, only a tiny portion of Israeli citizens are settlers. And those who are living inside Israel just don't take that kind of initiative. And Shaul, you know, in terms of survey research, what I see is that among the settler community, it's a very small portion who are even open to this kind of thing. I've heard all the diversity that you're talking about. I've experienced it. It's fascinating. It's small. You know, the vast majority of settlers, when we survey them, you know, hold really hardline attitudes. So I think that these are small, there are variations, but they represent a small portion of the settler population. So I don't necessarily think this is a mass movement, but I don't necessarily think that matters.
That prompts the question, I think.
They're important too.
And it relates to the topic of our webinar. And by the way, before I ask the question, I just would like to remind our audience, you can already type your questions in the Q&A box, and we'll get to it when we finish this discussion. But if you have questions already, feel free to type them. I'd like to ask you, Shaul, based on what Daniel just said, do you feel that you are, in a way, closer to Palestinians, both within Israel and in the West Bank, ideologically or however you like to call it, than some Israelis, Zionists, who believe first and foremost in a Jewish state that relies on a Jewish majority?
So now I believe in I'm a Zionist. I believe in a Jewish majority. I want a Jewish state. For me, a state is the place that Judaism intended. You know, Judaism is a religious word. Judaism means religion. For me, that's not where our people's destiny, our mission is to create a society. And today, modern, that's a state where the laws of Shemitah can impact economic policy, where questions of economic justice can get their inspiration from our Bible. And that's a Jewish story in this land. And there's a Palestinian national.
What about demographic?
Demographic? Listen, I think I think in that way, there's a demographic need for it. I think the nation state law that came up last year, it was done in a very vicious and us against them way. But I think the question there, the tensions within Zionism, the Jewish majority, a democratic Jewish state, it's a very important conversation for Israel to have. What does that mean? What does that Jewish state mean? What's the space of non-Jews in it? But can I ever really expect a Palestinian citizen of Israel to feel at home with a tikvah? No. Am I ever going to take away a tikvah? No, that's a people's song. There needs to be a Palestinian national anthem, Palestinian national home as well for their national aspirations to find their place in. So that, in that way, there's something similar. You know, at Roots, I can say, at the end of the day, Roots took the decision that we're not adopting this political plan or another, because the important thing right now is engaging. As Dalia said, you talk about solution, nobody's interested. There's no trust. There's no movement there's no movement. There hasn't been a peace process in at least 12 years, if we go back to Olmert and Abbas. And that was, for me, the work is on the ground. As Dalia said, the people where there is an action, how do you build that? How do you build trust? How do you understand what your role is? My conversation about the conflict is not with Israeli society as much as with Palestinian society. How do we change the face of Israel to Palestinian society? And I'll do that especially with a kippah on my head, representing myself, being here as a religious Jew, believes in our connection, religious me in the whole Jewish story and the whole spiel. Okay, fine, we're here. But that also gives me moral responsibility, also gives me a challenge, and to see, and can a conversation be created between Judaism and Islam here? Is there a way to come to a religious? I think that the religious aspect of the work at Roots is critical. I'm not calling it a religious conflict, but I'm saying the face of, we once brought a sheikh to speak before, it's going to give understanding. And he said, until the prime minister of Israel has a kippah in their head, you'll never be accepted in the Muslim world. And I can argue about all kinds of things, but there's a statement there about what's the face of Israel to Palestinian society and Muslim society and Arab society and Arab world at large. Are we Western invaders who came and took their land and brought in all kinds of things? Or are we the Jewish people that came back, or the Jews that came back? And that's a very important question in the resolving, if we were talking about, to really go back to things of resolving this conflict, I think, to kind of a space where both national stories can find a space for this side's legitimacy. Israel is not legitimate in Palestinian eyes. I mean, it's encroachingly legitimate on a political level, but really, it was made by force. It's on Palestinian land. And I think that's a conversation that I've had to internalize and learn, and talk about peacemaking really starts in many ways. It also starts in showing up on the activist kind of issues.
Tanya, do you think that this work on the grassroots level trickles up or down to the political level, that there's like an interrelation between the two, one feeding the other, that with enough grassroots work, the political landscape could change?
That's a very tough question. And, you know, I work on lots of conflicts in addition to the one that I live in. And I don't know if I have one hard answer. I mean, I do think grassroots work is important. For what reason? It's hard for me to say that it has a direct impact, that it directly changes political policy, especially if it's not oriented towards, you know, a particular political framework. It's hard to say that that's the outcome. Having said that, I don't know if I need a kind of social science study to prove what my instincts tell me, that when people are communicating and talking and hearing each other, especially outside the headlines, it has to be a good thing. I can't tell you how often I speak with people or watch focus groups and people are regurgitating news headlines without actually experiencing any of the, you know, reality of the other side for themselves. And there, you know, you cannot convince me it's a bad thing for them to actually learn about each other. In whatever future we have together, that's only going to serve us well. Will it bring the change? I don't think it can bring the change on its own if there never is, you know, a goal that they're trying to get to. So I think that there's a role for anybody who just wants to do dialogue, but without the additional piece of somebody somewhere advancing a political resolution, I suppose it will remain at the level of those specific people who get along nicely, and it might not have any what they call a ripple effect. But I think that if there is, you know, I think to some extent these networks are really valuable for that moment. When that moment happens, you know, when there is some sort of a political breakthrough, which sometimes happens surprisingly out of the blue. You guys may not remember because you're so, I think you're all younger than me, but I remember when Oslo was signed. It really was a secret up until then. Mm-hmm. Nobody believed it was happening. And maybe at the very, very, you know, elite, wonky leadership level, people had some indication. But sometimes things can change really fast. And we see that in other parts of the world, too. If anybody's following Ethiopia and Eritrea, like I am. Mm-hmm. So when those things happen, we better be ready. Because if we're not ready, you know, as Shola pointed out, the lack of trust will, you know, could very easily bring down a process, which is, of course, what we saw in Oslo for all sorts of reasons. I also want to make a point about this concept of lack of trust. I don't think, Shaul, you meant it in the way that I'm about to say, but I think often I hear people say, you know, it's so unfortunate there's a lack of trust and therefore we can't move ahead. Lack of trust comes from somewhere. It's not just that people woke up one day and decided not to trust each other. It's that each side is constantly repeating and not even a symmetrical way. These are different kinds of things, but the sides are constantly doing, you know, repeating the injury to one another. The political stagnation is a reason for that trust. Leadership's bad decisions, individual acts of violence and loss. I think it's a little bit unfair when we say, oh, there's a lack of trust, if we could just change that. That, I don't think, is the kind of thing you just change by people-to-people activities. I think it helps, but it has to be met either with a political vision, but ideally with a middle level of changing, you know, day-to-day reality as well. And so, you know, if the grassroots roots approach also changes day-to-day reality for more people, that certainly will contribute to their effectiveness. And, you know, maybe eventually when there's a political breakthrough, people will be a little more prepared to accept it. I think if they see, you know, day-to-day, we actually kind of can get along, we're just waiting for a resolution to put a name on it, we'd be in a much better situation.
I have to know. It's somehow the world of coexistence projects always gets, I mean, Roots gets tagged as dialogue project. Dialogue is a means to engage people and have them take active responsibility. To see 500 Jews come up and visit and work for a Palestinian house that was being destroyed, or to go sign on for a permit, for working for permits. It's that kind of engagement. That's the goal here, is getting people engaged, to recognize their responsibility to the other side, and then to step into those actions. That's dialogue's not going to solve the conflict. You're right. It can help us become aware what the issues really are, to burst our bubble if we thought this is what the issues are, and really they're absolutely different. I mean, Dalia, you published a study a few years ago that really stuck with me. It said of the 45% of Israelis then who opposed the two-state solution, I think 70% of them would change their mind if Palestine would recognize Israel as a Jewish state.
Yeah, that's, it wasn't 70%, but it was high. It was high.
It was very high.
That's one of the most effective means. And I think that in general, you know, the deep symbolic recognition of the other is enormously powerful on both sides.
And for the Israeli, the Palestinian refugees, which is an issue most Israelis will not even mention, touch, want to talk about, and that's very a core issue here. And that's a discourse that comes from the experience of having the threat of having to lose your home for peace, or being told you're not going home in the name of peace. And that's a very deep divide between a Palestinian national narrative and a settler national narrative, where both feel very deep connection to this land and this land as a whole. and a sense of homeland. And there's something that comes up in that recognition that for me is that's the deepest part of the dialogue. When an Israeli group can hear a Palestinian, when Israeli youngsters can hear a Palestinian talk about this land being your people's land. And when Palestinian youngsters can hear Israelis talking about Palestine from the river to the sea. And those are obviously on a certain level, those are two exclusive truths, but I think they're absolutely the reality. And that for me is that's the pointy part of the religiosity dialogue part, but it's really about action. It's, you know, Roots started in this area. We have another project going in Jordan Valley now. We have a whole slew of people involved and interested in moving these things forward in the northern part of the West Bank, Judea, Samaria. And there's a lot of people, we're looking for the pragmatic voices. I don't care about the ideologies as much. And the people who are the moderate voice, how do you empower the moderate voice in this conflict? Where do you create the space where you can face? And for me, the trust building, like you said, the only trust that I'm going to gain as an Israeli is from the Palestinian. And I think the only trust the Palestinians can gain is when they see an Israeli standing up for their rights. And that the ability to do that is so, you know, in the unilateral political step from everything from BDS and Tadbiyah and in Israeli tiredness, creating that space is something very rare in the political, even in the joint activity. You know, the joint activities get blasted because of the despair with the diplomatic process. Finding still a way to do that is still an important work. And Northern Ireland is probably the best example of how grassroots work in a long-term conflict did have a key role in allowing the leaders to move forward with something. Sure. I don't think our leaders can surprise us with a hidden agreement again. I think it'll provoke probably our extremists. Not. And what will happen then will be the same. You know, we go on the same path again.
No, I don't think they'll surprise us, but I do think that if in the right confluence of circumstances, things might move ahead faster than we think. And I also want to say, Shaul, I think that what you're describing about what Roots does doesn't totally fall into the old, you know, dialogue category. You're talking about activism. I mean, you're talking about actually taking on a concrete role to reverse some of that damage that's being done on either side. And I think that, you know, should fall outside of the old understanding of the 1990s. You know,
right.
I once remember there was an organization called like Handball for Peace. I mean, that's not what you guys are doing. And I think it's important to make that distinction because even the anti-normalization movement makes that distinction, right? The idea of co-resistance, okay, maybe you don't call yourselves co-resistance, but the kinds of activities you're describing are much more activist.
Shaul, I want to ask you whether you see the Israeli Jewish public as part of your target audience as well, and whether you see yourself as part of the broader peace camp, if you want to call it that, or maybe you have an alternative term for it, because at the end of the day, people the supporters of Partners for Progressive Israel and other like-minded organizations in Israel, don't think you should be living where you're living in the first place. Is that a non-starter for you?
Sure. Israeli public is definitely our target audience. I think Israeli public lives very sheltered from Palestinian voices. If we can do our part in bringing a Palestinian voice to confront that, I think that's important. Also, I think the evolution of Zionism, I think, is a part. We spoke to over 3,500 pre-Army Academy kids last year. And they heard one person on the one hand, an Israeli Jewish religious Zionist talking about connection to the land, but talking about how where that leads us and the need to understand Palestinian nationalism as part of that story. And they also heard from a Palestinian telling their life story and telling what it means to them, who and what it's going to be a soldier in 6 months, and confronting with that reality too. That's like Dalia put out. It's a sheltered reality. With the left, I think, I'll go back to what Dalia said at the beginning. If we're sure what the answer is, we're just going to keep pushing for it. You're right. There's not much to talk to. I think Meretz youth refuse to come meet us because if you want to make peace, leave the settlements. But I also think a lot of Israelis and Palestinians are having thoughts. Well, where does this go? What's reality? What can be changed? Some of my Palestinian partners joke, it takes me, a Palestinian, to bring you to talk here. And
then they'll be happy to know we're doing this conversation.
Right, I know, right. So he got it. But I think there's a challenge to the left. I think there's a challenge, just like there's a challenge for my camp as well. You know, we need to stand here to challenge ourselves here. And, if we're standing, I was disappointed in the election. You know, Meretz and stood with the same platform they basically ran in 1993. Two-state solution, and the same thing. Where's the innovation? We're 30 years later. Can somebody, and there's some people way down on the Meretz list who I think are thinking different ways. But we're still holding as if that's going to magically happen. We're missing realities. We're missing big changes in Palestinian society that are happening too, that are fascinating, important, and we live really sheltered from. And we're pushing ourselves into the corner. You're right. The you know, the way my community reacts to these kinds of things is latent with just the traumas of what people go. You know, when I go to pray in the morning, when I make it to the synagogue, there's three fathers saying Kaddish for their children that were stabbed or stoned to death. And that level of trauma that's part of the conversation is a very big part of what's at part, I think, in the politics later on. And I think that's something that's also shared by Israeli society as a whole. But I think that being the challenge that I said, Roots is about people to people, activism, and discourse, and changing a discourse here that that we've seen fail, that we need to renew, that needs to think forward, you know, think forwardly about where realities are.
We'll soon open the conversation to questions from our audience. So if you have any questions, please type them in the Q&A box that you see on your screen. And if you don't, just hover with your cursor on the screen. Dalia, one of the possible solutions or ways forward, thought of a better word, that you've written a lot about is the concept of confederation rather than two-state solution or one-state solution, a way to break the impasse. Do you see any of Shaul's and Root's work feeding into that broader concept of confederation?
Yeah, I do. I mean, for anybody who isn't familiar with the idea, it's a different version of a two-state solution in the sense that it allows for national self-determination of both sides. We're not talking about one state or one binational state or one democratic civic national state. We're talking about Palestinians having self-determination and Israel in broad territorial zones, but with a lot more openness and overlap and sort of recognizing the reality of mutual dependency, intertwined populations, economy, security needs, tiny physical space. So, you know, open borders with joint security, of course, not to give up on borders, but to allow them to be borders that are porous, where people can move and work and study and live, and allowing people to live as residents with citizenship in their national side. But, you know, if they're settlers and they're not, you know, if they're law-abiding settlers, they can live on the Palestinian side. Some Palestinian refugees who have claims can live as residents in Israel, but citizens in Palestine. So no side can actually flood the other side and outvote them because they would only vote in their place of citizenship. Jerusalem would remain united rather than, you know, put up a Jerusalem wall down the middle. There are lots of other things that I could get into, but just to give you the basic idea. And the reason why I became interested in this was, first of all, the realization that the old two-state solution was never going to happen politically and physically. But also I started to realize that it reflects reality on the ground much better. I think what Shaul is describing to us is one form of that. But I think in reality, you know, it's a little bit paradoxical, but the places where there is overlap between Israelis and Palestinians on the ground, we don't hear about it in the news because it doesn't make the news when nothing happens. But a lot of those interactions are positive. On the personal level, they are not positive on the political level. So what we need to do is, to my mind, I started to realize, you know, you don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater. It's better to leverage what's going well on the you know, again, like on the ground. I keep repeating it. When I see it on the ground, people are getting along, being, you know, economically interdependent, benefiting one another's lives, actually having some sorts of friendships. But what drives them apart is the lack of political equality. That's the problem that needs to be solved. Now, again, I don't pretend that's going to solve every security problem. I don't pretend that there's any human society in the world that has eradicated crime. But I think that there's no point in creating further trauma that would happen when you ethnically segregate populations. And as a kind of a lifelong two-stater, you know, over the course of several years, I realized that, why am I supporting ethnic segregation? That doesn't seem like a very humanist perspective. It certainly doesn't seem like a very liberal perspective to say that, well, we can't live together because we're ethnically different. And it's not politically realistic anyway. And, you know, for other reasons, I think it would cause harm. So I do see what Shaul is talking about as one further example of the many examples I see where the fabric of life is sufficiently intertwined and not necessarily in bad ways and even in good ways, that ought to be leveraged and we should find a political framework for resolution that kind of molds itself around that rather than ripping it apart, I think, artificially.
Joel, do you find this concept appealing?
as a place where it could go, yeah, I think it's a, like, does it, there's a pragmatism to it. I think the mistrust, the idea of putting our security in joint security patrols is such a traumatic statement for Israeli society today, especially out here, I'll say. And one of the deep, you know, traumas of Oslo is, look, we gave the PA police guns, and look, they ended up shooting them back at us. And those wounds or those traumas from the extremists are very deep in here. But if you want to go all the way and really open up your eyes and look, here's a Palestinian story, and say neither of those things are going to go away, those claims to the land and confederation is a very logical place to end up. Like I said, I think most of the resistance to it is mostly a sense of fear on the Israeli side, the sense of fear. There's a suspicion of things new. But you know, earlier this year, we actually had a meeting between us and some people from Two States, from the One Land for All. And the question is, both of our initiatives are telling our societies cooperation, working together, that means is part of the end as well, perhaps. And that society is counter to a lot of where Israeli society feels, on the right and on the left, too. The sense of separation, us and them, there's no partner, hold the bunker, fortress, and all that. So it is a very challenging message to bring across. But I find it gets a lot, when that trust factor, you know, what is that trust factor? It's an important question. But when that starts being built, it offers a challenge to the extremist, the exclusivist holds on this land, which is something both sides are going to have to deal with. And on a paradoxical way, even that's a political statement. That political statement, what it needs is those examples on the ground to point to, that this is where it can go. If it's about collaborative areas, or if there's two states, but there's zones where there's collective work or shared sovereignty. But I think to go all the way is much stronger, to say that there's a homeland here. And that also forces both sides to recognize it as that homeland. It's not an easy claim or easy thing to recognize, but it's from
I'm gonna paraphrase now a question that we got from Noah Bornstein. You mentioned earlier that the Palestinians should have their own country, where they can have their own anthem, etc. Is that really? I mean, where that could be achieved as part of, you know, perhaps a broader arrangement, a broader alignment of the political forces?
Are you asking me, or
I'm asking Shaul?
I mean, I said that. I mean, that's what coming to terms with a national identity on both sides means. I mean, right. That's why I sense two states, a confederation there. You know, that's the, what got two states got right. There's two national stories here. They're never really going to live happily ever after. In this, you know, we're going to end up fighting over who's our flag.
Right, and say that a two state solution is achieved. Now it seems against all odds, but say that there's a Palestinian state and a Jewish Israeli state, and that would require either that you evacuate your settlement or that you stay under Palestinian sovereignty. Have you ever given thought to what you might do?
I get asked that question a lot. I really give very little time to that. You know, it's the how we would get there, how we get there from today. That'll determine a lot on how I react. If I resist and I put myself in front of the bulldozer, if I say, this is a logical solution, here we go. It's really hard to say. I remember two elections ago when people thought the left was going to come into power, and I went to go put my vote, and I said, okay, God, here we go. The left wins. Maybe they'll implement the two-state solution. Who knows what will happen? Maybe in 5 years we'll end up in an old-fashioned war and we'll have to reconquer and things will break. Who knows what will happen? I trust it's going to happen. So I don't spend a lot of time facing that situation. I do say I think a Palestinian state that can have Jews who live in it, makes me raise my eyebrows, that piece. If we get past Foucault and, you know, have to cleanse and get rid of the oppressor, fine. But there can't be a Jew who lives in Palestine? That for me is a big question. Then that's for me what Gabi started. We need some alternate solutions here, because that's not really something that's going to gain my trust. I think in that I'm kind of like a generalist, really. The two-state solution, fine, but I don't trust that solution right now. I don't trust creating a Palestinian state, even though I come to terms with Palestinian nationalism. And in that way, I feel very stuck.
Okay, now there's a question for, I think, both of you. Let's start with you, Dalit, from Marsha G. Yerman. Where do you see American Jews in this equation?
I'm still encountering many, many, many American Jews, many more than I remember when I was, you know, first getting interested in Israel when I was a teenager, and then a late teenager, and then in my early 20s, and started spending time in Israel. For anybody, I'm from New York originally. And I kind of was generally aware of that there was a political conflict, and I came here to figure it out, and figured out that if I wanted to be here, I had to work on resolving it. It seemed like a pretty logical progression in terms of my interest in Israel. But nowadays, amazingly, despite so much attention to this conflict, I encounter just American Jew one after the other, American Jews one after the other, who come here and say, I didn't realize there is an occupation, there is a conflict, Israel's doing these things I didn't know about, I wasn't aware of this, and now I'm shocked because my whole vision of the country that I was brought up to look up to is changing. And I feel like that has to change. It's amazing to me because there's so much more activism, I think, in America than there ever was when I was growing up around this issue, you know, to talk about these things. But it's still happening. And I think that, you know, the first, you know, the starting point, like the door to everything else is knowing what's going on. And it's hard. I guess it's hard to read beyond the headlines, even though I also think we're in an age when we have more information if we want it than ever before. But I think that people, at the same time, I personally think the culture of Hasbara is really destructive because people learn how to tell and not how to listen. On all sides, maybe. But if you're asking about American Jews, I think they need to, like, you know, distinguish between what they're being told and come and see for themselves. Everything, good and bad, you know, all sides. And really try to think critically about what's going on here and then choose their own path. I mean, I don't think anybody, I'm not telling anybody they have to subscribe to my way of looking at things. But I do think when people are more informed, they will come out better. I know that sounds a little bit vague, but I do think it's the starting point. After that, you know, for American Jews who are generally oriented towards finding a resolution, yeah, I would say the process that people like Shul and I seem to have gone through, which is, you know, opening up what we thought was the best approach 10 years ago or 20 years ago and reimagining what we think needs to be done. I think American Jews need to do that really badly because right now, seems like any American Jew who would like to see this conflict resolved and believes that they support peace, they generally by default support the two-state solution or just this vague, you know, peace. That's not going to be enough at a certain point. They have to influence the American policy debate. They have to empower American politicians to look at different policies and different approaches. You know, I know this probably sounds like a pie in the sky path towards the American government adopting a two-state confederation, but we're not going anywhere else right now, so we better be moving somewhere. And it's going to need everybody to do it: Israeli Jews, Palestinians, Palestinian citizens of Israel, American Jews, American policy people, Europeans. Everybody's going to need to pitch in towards some eventual political framework for resolution. So,
what's your take on the role of American Jews in all this?
I mean, obviously, as an American Jew, everybody has a connection to, I'm not everybody, a lot of people feel a very powerful connection to this, what's going on here. And like Dali said, it's a lot through the headlines and we've read. And I said, the difference between the headlines of this conflict and the experience of this conflict are so vast. And that chasm everybody talking between American Jewry and Israeli Jewry, the visceral things you feel here in the conflict, and the things that society have gone through, and even the history that people have lived, obviously nobody's going to pick up. But there's a lot of, to impact something that's on the other side of the world, is challenging to come up with to be able to talk to people on either side beyond the headline and actually the empathy to develop empathy for both sides or what's going on here, the story. For me, I think, you know, in terms of activism in the U.S. right now, there's a bill in Congress. You should call your congressperson and ask them to support to invest again in joint Israeli-Palestinian work. It's, you know, Mr. Trump canceled a lot of that funding and it's an important bill right now out there. But there's a lot of coming to terms with, I think it's about moving the Israeli and the Palestinian body politic. And to learn how to speak and have those conversations, not just sort of, oh, my Israeli cousins are this or my Palestinian cousins are that. There's a need to be able to hear where those people are coming from and to be able to speak to those fears, because those are the vote in many ways are going to be here. Who knows where politics go in 5 years, but I think there's a don't give up. I just read J Street just started their alternative birthright thing. I read when somebody just wrote a kid, J Street exposed, what do you say? J Street's birthright replacement trip to Israel killed my Zionism. So to kill my Zionism means like I just like gave up on Israel. And how are you going to change things if you've given up on it? You can disconnect. You can work against. Fine. But I think there's a lot of people getting into the working against. And that's Hasbara came from. We need to work against their narrative to counter their narrative. And how do you find a way to work for self-determination for both peoples? That's a challenge. And But I think it takes, the first is the listening and being able to hear both sides and step deeper into that space.
Okay, can I also add a little bit? I just want to say, not to take this in a completely mushy direction, but I really think this is important. Young people, campus, we hear all this criticism of the campus environment, whether it's the anti-Israel, apartheid week, or the Israeli Hasbara culture on campus, training people from a young age to tell the stories. I really think that one of the things that drives me kind of nuts is when I hear things like signaling. I know that's the expression, but when people don't truly necessarily know a lot about the position they're taking, but they know they have to be on that side of the divide. And I think that is, a destructive way to look at stuff. I could also say it's like having litmus tests. Like anybody, and from the left, they would say anybody who's a settler has failed my litmus test. I'm not going to talk to them. I don't think that's helpful. Or saying anybody who supports BDS, that's my litmus test. I won't talk to them if you're from the right. I think people have to really, get out of these categories. Stop with the litmus tests. Stop with the signaling, taking a position just because it's your camp, without really thinking through and learning the position. And I really think that these are like this is the foundation level of having a more sensitive, compassionate dialogue, understanding of the situation here, which is, I think, the only way to kind of open our minds towards different political solutions.
Okay, now we have a question from Gilly Getz. What about the argument that these are your efforts, Sheryl and Roots, your efforts compromise the urgency and crisis of addressing the occupation, create a sense that things are working themselves out, and create an impression of a balanced conflict versus the imbalance of power that is the reality on the ground, after all?
Right, the question, listen, at Roots, we envision a social and political reality that is founded on dignity, trust, and mutual recognition and respect for both people's historic belonging to the entire land. How do we get there? Right, there's a power imbalance right now. But one of the cores of Roots is change, meaning the situations right now is not just, it's not right, it's not good for Israelis, it's not good for Palestinians. I said it's not good for Palestinians, it's not good for Israelis. How do we change that? The simple thing, if we just move out of the West Bank, we'd go. If Israel would just remove all the checkpoints, it would be better. It's not true. It's not true. Until we build partnership, until we develop political models that can actually end the occupation, there's no ending the occupation. Meaning it's not going to magically go away because it's wrong. We need to develop political will to move somewhere. There's changes that are happening on the Palestinian side that need to happen, on the Israeli side. I think it goes, sometimes people ask me, you live in an illegal settlement. Doesn't it bother you, or is something wrong with that? Honestly, the international judgment of this being a legal settlement is so far from the way anybody I interact with or how I live, illegal. What are you talking about? And there's a conflict going on here, which feels like a conflict, not a court case. The chance to make a just adjudications and fill the lines is if we're, that's not the place where the conflict's taking place. The conflict's in a very visceral sense of war, of going to war. Of how do we change that from within here is the question here. For a lot of Palestinians, the word conflict is a total lie. What do you mean? There's an occupation. There's no conflict. Look at the power imbalance. Okay, but tell that to Israelis that there's no conflict. Tell that to my neighbor whose daughter was just raped and murdered 3 months ago. That's resistance to occupation. No, but there's still a conflict. There's a bigger, I think, so I feel like that approach misses out on where the subjective storyline is here on the ground. I guess my I live here on the ground. I live in it. It's my community. It's my life. It's my kids. It's my drive to work. Somebody asked me, what does peace mean to you? Peace means being able to roll down the windows in the back seat when my kids are in the car. On a very simple level, that's what people are living here. So tell me, I come to the conflict from a different space. And the asymmetries, I think we have to get our society, Israeli society, the right-wing community here, to look at the asymmetries and step up their action. That's a satisfactory answer, but.
I mean, I want to weigh, I'd love to weigh in on it, because my first answer to Gili's question was going to be like, what planet are we on? Nobody feels the urgency. So the choice is not between what Sheol is doing and an extremely urgent activist movement towards peace. It's what Sheol is doing or nothing. So I would say in that situation, let's do this kind of thing. However, Sheol, mm-hmm. when you say, yeah. I'm coming at this from a different angle, it's not a legal battle, it's a, it's not that kind of conflict. I have to also, that also makes me think, okay, your reality is that you want to be able to drive with the windows down. But the reality also is that the people living next to you are living under totally different laws. If your kid throws a stone and their kid throws a stone, their kid will be sent to jail without evidence. And they probably, you know, they may not have enough electricity or enough water. Their home is destroyed. Absolutely. And ours and ours isn't. And so it's.
But is that a question of, that's not a question of illegal settlements. That's a question of political rights and solutions of the conflict.
Right.
It's not about illegal occupation. You know, it's not about a UN. It's not about a UN resolution that said over this line is here and that's not Israel and that's not Palestine. And that's, I think, shifting the way we approach this conflict from convinced that it's, you know, if we say it's just the occupation, you know, Israel, the right wants to say it's about terrorism and incitement. That's what the conflict's about. If there wasn't that, we'd all be living in peace. The Palestinians is about occupation. No, there's much more core issues here. And there's a lack of a political settlement that can, a political deal that can give both people those rights. And I'm not sure that the legal argument is what's going to tilt it this way or that way. It's about Israeli and Palestinian society being able to come to that political will. And I acknowledge Israel has the power. It's on us to make first step, don't make overtures. But Palestinian society is not, you know, Hamas very much upset the Oslo peace process, as did Baruch Goldstein. But if there wasn't Hamas terrorists, there wouldn't, you know, those suicide bombs which were geared to stop the peace process, they wouldn't have succeeded. There's still agency on both sides, I want to say.
I mean, I agree. It's just that I think that we get to the situation where we have to admit that the left can't solve all violence with a peace process.
Sure.
But if Hamas went away and terrorism went away, Israel would not all of a sudden automatically grant equal rights. And so that's like that's the starting reality. It's not a very, it's a bleak one, but it's kind of true.
Okay, I don't know. I think that's a good question, you know, and it's true. I think that the periods of calm that have gone by, you know, with less attacks, they haven't inspired Israeli society to come and say, now we're willing to succeed. But there's also a lot of other reasons, though, regional reasons that also come into that. And that's why I think at the end of the day, it's about when people came to Roots and they said, we want to do a thing about you have a summer camp with Palestinians and Israeli kids together, amazing. I said, don't talk about our summer camp. Go talk about what's happening in Palestinian society. Go talk about the Zimam or talk about Palestinian organizations calling for citizenship or the work, what's going on. Because Israelis need to see who's going to be our neighbor. Who's going to be that society we're living next to? That's what's going to give Israelis the sense to go vote for somebody. Not somebody's going to tell you, always pointing you how evil you are, but somebody, what's being built in Palestine. And there's a world of Palestinian activists who are trying to do that work within society. There's a lot of frustration, but there's a lot of good things happening too. And I think that's what's going to, a friend of mine said, the moment there'll be 10,000 Palestinians marching for peace in Ramallah, there'll be 150,000 Israelis marching in Tel Aviv. And that kind of, we'll have extremists, we have extremist views. Who's going to take care of them? We need to give the political will to people who can. So I just want to go back. There still remains agency on both sides. We have a lot more responsibility here right now. And it's very hard to gain that political will to people. It's very hard to worship, you know, to work on those traumas. Like you said, this voice in my community is a small voice, but there's people there. And there's some serious people there, people whose names, you know, I can't say on a broadcast, but people thinking about it and talking about it and behind closed doors doing things. And that's why a lot of our work is behind closed doors. But I, you know, otherwise I come with a sense of, you know, the settlements are legal, that's wrong. Or Israel's more powerful, it's your fault. And that's why I don't like that. That's what I guess what kind of triggers me in those kinds of questions.
Okay, we're quickly running out of time, so I'll take another two questions and please answer them briefly. Show, there's a question for you. Why did you choose to move to the West Bank, to Tekoa, in the first place and not anywhere else in Eretz Israel?
I'd say because there's some pretty incredible communities that exist here. Tekoa is an amazing community. There's a renaissance of Jewish life that's going on, particularly in, what I connect to is what's here in Gush Etzion, between music and Jewish life and the land, and that's really happening only here. And I think it's something connected to this. There's also a level of a very high level of community happening here. That's something that, you know, I think I was looking for. I think Tekoa especially, there's a religious secular project going on in the town of Tekoa that I think is something very critical to Israeli society and inner issues. And at the end of the day, I think that this can somehow become part of the solution.
But the fact that it was in the West Bank was never an issue for you.
I moved out here in 2001 when buses were blowing up and my cousin was being killed, and they were getting, every time we came out of Jerusalem, there were shots fired on the road. You're telling me we're just going to put, and rockets fired from here and rockets fired from there. The sense of, you know, we're just going to pull back, it's going to be okay. Like I said, if you see this as a peace process, reality is a peace process, then you say it's wrong. If you see this as an existential conflict between these two Israeli side, Palestinian conflict, which I think a lot of people here feel, then it becomes less of a question, I guess. But through time that changed. I got out of that sense of it's us or them, and that's always going to be. But still, I feel committed that part of the solution comes from here. But I live here because of the communities here, though. I mean, in a sense, and the land, you know, and what's here. All right, it's a powerful part of this also. Okay. Anybody wants to, there's a documentary by Irizaki called The Unsettling, I think, Unsettled. It's a little glimpse of Tekoa. You can take it for what it's worth, but it's important to break down these stereotypes and look who's there, I think, also.
It's interesting because this just kind of preempted the next question that maybe you can elaborate on by Melissa Alexander, who was at a Friends of Roots event in May. Three exclamation points. So she was very apparently very happy about that. And she would like to know how she can spread the word. And she lives in Portland, Oregon. And how can she raise the profile of Roots and Friends of Roots and the work that you do in the U.S.?
Thank you. I mean, there's a Facebook Friends of Roots group. We're sending speakers to speak in North America and in November. You can look on our website, it's friendsofroots.net. There's information there. There's also resources there, bringing Palestinian voices, Israeli voices, talking about the work going on. Like I said, that bill in Congress, I think, is a very real thing that's going to help a lot of organizations, not just that. There's ALMEP, the Alliance for Middle East Peace, which is a conglomerate of about 120 different Israeli and Palestinian organizations. They're doing lobbying work. But the Facebook site or the website's a good place just to share it. I think Dali mentioned the news. We live in our news cycle, what's going on there. And I'm not here to whitewash and say everything's hunky-dory and fine, but there's a lot of positive things that are happening. There's a lot of dynamic changes to look and support and get and learn more about. And I just encourage that people to do that in all different ways.
Okay, we've got 3 minutes. Dalia, would you like to deliver your closing statement?
I don't really have a closing statement since we agreed this is not only about a legal kind of conceptualization of the conflict. But I guess there's just one point that I meant to make earlier, maybe not totally in context as a conclusion, but I still think it's important. In some ways, we are looking at a religious conflict. And what I mean, I don't mean between Jews and Muslims. I mean between people with a secular worldview and people with a religious worldview. They really are fundamentally different. I mean, I know this as somebody who kind of straddles, right? I grew up in a conservative Jewish household, so I know what it means to be sort of 1 foot in religion and 1 foot in the secular world. But I also know it as a pollster because the numbers are unmistakable. We're talking about completely different kind of concepts and value systems. And I think that I'm saying that not in order to depress everybody or to make one side feel like they're the wrong side or the right side, which I think is too often the case, right? Each side gets a little bit self-righteous about their perspective, both sides, including my own. I hear it, I see it, I feel it, I don't think it's healthy. And I think that, you know, you can do no better than to try and really put your, you know, understand that there are people who have fundamentally different, you know, value systems, and that even if they're not yours, you're never going to get anywhere by pretending they don't exist or that they're all wrong and stupid. The only way to get somewhere is to try to understand them. You don't have to adopt them, you don't have to subscribe to them. And I don't mean to harangue anybody because, you know, I hope everybody knows this already, but too often I find that people don't know that. And so I think that's the value of us having this conversation. And, you know, certainly the value of, again, across the religious divide, having those conversations. And you know, maybe we, you know, become a little bit less self-reinforcing and a little more open to how the other side thinks, and maybe we'll get somewhere one day.
Okay. Sean, last thoughts?
I really resonate with Dali just said there. I think we find that a way, definitely in the intra-Jewish conversation, but this need to understand there's different perspectives and different things at all, but also in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I think a lot of the faith and surprise for both peoples, you know, is that religious meeting, that sense of what this land means to the other side and a religious value. And you have a lot of exclusive thinking where it's only ours and it's not really that real for them, and coming to terms with that is very true. As Rabbi Fumin used to scream here in Rosh Hashanah and Tekoa in the synagogue, Allahu Akbar, which means God is bigger, it's more, and that blink to be surprised and to be open to that is critical here. And against it also the space of, I would say, roots in a certain way is a prayer, as is life in Israel is a prayer, as is life in Palestine is a prayer. Will this community last? I don't know. Will this project last? Will peace come? Those are all big prayers that we have. And the enemy here of the Hebrews, as Rabbi Freeman said, is hubris. And the hubris people. It's a big thing to be aware of in all of these political escapades and attempts at activism too, I think also.
You caught us all in a philosophical mood.
Yeah, wow. It's a great mood to end on. So thank you very much, Dr. Darius Endlin and Rabbi Shaul Yudelman. Thank you very much for joining us today for this webinar.
Thank you.
And thank you, the audience, for joining us for this Conversations with Israel and Palestine. I would like to thank you, to thank the staff of Partners for Progressive Israel for the work in making this discussion happen. You too can go to progressiveisrael.org to learn more about Partners for Progressive Israel and their future programs. Thank you very much. I was Gilad Halpern. Thanks a lot for joining us.